on Radio National.
The Big Weekend of Books.
Hello, I'm Andrew Ford. I present The Music Show on Radio National, and you're about to hear a conversation with Andrew O'Hagan and David Mitchell about their novels Mayflies and Utopia Avenue, which were both published last year, and both of which deal a lot with the subject of music. And that music that you can hear, if you haven't recognised it already, is Tubeway Army's Our Friends Electric from 1979. I did ask each of our guests that they would choose a bit of music for us, and this was Andrew O'Hagan's choice. Andrew, hello, and perhaps you could tell us first about Tubeway Army. Why did you choose that? You could have chosen so many things from this era.
Hi, Andy. Well, it was such an ambition of mine that aliens might land in Scotland sometime around 1979, just as Margaret Thatcher took power. I felt that the future was both frightening and much to be welcomed. And suddenly there was a soundtrack to that feeling. It was on Top of the Pops. There was a strange guy with dyed hair standing at a mic looking alien and strange and remote, but also, again, to be much welcomed. And his name was Gary Newman, and the band was Tubeway Army. They were singing that song. And I remember running down the stairs and just standing, 10 years old in pajamas, staring at the screen, as this guy was doing something which I'd never quite realized could be done, which was that he wasn't just a pop star. He was like an ordinary guy playing the part of a pop star in his bedroom mirror. He was taking off David Bowie so comprehensively that it was sort of hilarious and amazing to me. And I remember turning to my brothers and saying, "Is that a joke?" And they said, "No, it's completely brilliant." And of course, they were right. It seemed to signal a whole new way of being a pop star to me. And the music itself, too, was so kind of astringent and kind of weirdly, I mean, it sounds quite old-fashioned now, of course, but just the synths of the thing sounded so kind of otherworldly in your sitting room in a housing estate outside Glasgow, which is where I was. It just sounded new, and the newness was a kind of manufactured thing that I responded to somehow. I just kind of loved it, and it brings back that time like nothing else.
That's the thing, though, isn't it, about this music, and particularly the music of our youth, that we carry it around with us. You know, songs are eminently portable, and whenever they come to mind, or whenever we just accidentally bump into one of them, there it is, our youth.
It's absolutely core, I think, to literature, what David and I are taken up with. You know, writing has always, to some extent, responded to the resonances of music, I think. When you think of Proust and his great novel, I mean, the little musical phrase that's heard early in that book, it resonates all the way through the volumes. I mean, it's incredible. More powerful, actually, though less famous than the Madeleine dipped in the Linden tea, is the little phrase heard at Madame Verdurin's salon. It just ignites, if you like, both feeling and memory in a complicated way. Proust was very alert to that. I mean, he was a great fan of music, a great attender at concerts and so on, as I think were we. Both of us as writers have always responded to music. It's sort of, it's sewn in, woven through so many of the things we've written. It's not always been as much of a subject, front and centre, as it is in Mayflies, this most recent book of mine, where music's defining power, if you like, is really the subject of the book. This group of boys are in search of a kind of people to be, and music helps them on their way, if you like. That's taking it, as it were, to an explicit level. But all through I think everything I've ever written, there has been the, if you like, the background murmur of the music I loved or responded to. And I think it's, I don't think I'm a great original in that way, or perhaps in any way. But Proust was there for me as a reminder of just how a personality can be constructed, if you like, through fragments of sound, music of the past.
David Mitchell, that is certainly true of you. I mean, music has been, I think, in all of your novels, but perhaps never quite as to the fore as it is in Utopia Avenue, which is a novel about a band. Towards the end, in the last, about 50 pages from the end of what is actually a very long novel, one of the band members, Jasper, says, and I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, "Songs do not change the world, people do, but who or what influences the minds of those who change the world? Ideas and feelings, and where do ideas and feelings originate? Others, one's heart and mind, the press, the arts, stories, last but not least, songs, like dandelion seeds." He's always going on about seeds, Jasper, billowing across space and time, and who knows where they'll land. That, to me, is the kind of crucial passage of the book, and in a way, maybe the crucial passage of our conversation. Did you think of it in those terms when you wrote it, David?
I can't quite remember the state I was in when I was writing that. It was towards the end of the book, and my editor was keen to see some manuscripts, so I'm not quite sure. I also can't quite let, if I may, the great Andrew O'Hagan get away with describing himself as not particularly original. He's a wonderful and original writer, and it's great to be having this conversation with him. As he was speaking, I was thinking of lots of things, not least just how I wonder if when we go deep, 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 deep down, whether at a subatomic level, so to speak, language and music aren't actually the same thing. We talk in quite a blasé way about the musicality of language and how, say, Italian sounds like a particularly musical language to an Anglophone ear, and some other languages share that or don't share it. But I think more profoundly, than sort of our fleeting impressions of the musicality of a language, is how what we are doing right now, speaking, composing sentences, launching them out, they have stress, they have meter, they have rhythm, or they don't. All those musical notations that you learn at school, crescendo, diminuendo, etc., they can also be applied to language. And I sometimes think just on the page that even a line of prose, it doesn't even have to be said, but I think the eyeball can hear the music of a sentence. And this is one reason that some sentences just make you go, wow. We might not be able to ordinarily pin down where that wow comes from, but I think a part of the wow is its music.
Well, but also the music often gives you the real meaning, doesn't it? It's how you can tell if someone's telling the truth, but the rising and falling of the voice, you know, the use of pitch and tempo and dynamics and everything else. I mean, that the words themselves don't necessarily convey the truth in speech, David.
Yes, indeed. There's a lot of nonverbal communication in communication. And a lot of that nonverbal communication is precisely this. It's a form of music. Of course, there's facial expressions and other things as well. But as we're doing now, in fact, a long-distance conversation, Australia, Scotland, Ireland, we aren't looking at each other's faces as we're speaking. We're listening very intently to what we're saying because we have to, because we are minus the verbal clues. And I think we're relying on the music of what we're saying quite a lot right now.
In your books, both of you, Andrew O'Hagan and David Mitchell, you try to represent music. You try to convey the sense of it. And of course, this is the great difficulty, as has been said on many occasions by many people, the difficulty of putting the sound of music into words. And yet it's sort of crucial, isn't it, to both of you. Andrew, maybe I could come back to you. You know, the way in which you convey the energy of those shows in Manchester. How did you set about that? And how did you try to find a way of getting the words which would actually give a sense of what the Smiths sounded like?
It's a really crucial and interesting question to me, that, because it actually goes to the heart of something technical. I mean, I'm sure David and I, for instance, could talk over a beer technical issues relating to the sound of music, as once famously put, and how the sentences one write respond to something sort of barely discernible or barely comprehensible in music itself. I mean, for example, I grew up loving punk. I couldn't say for sure that I knew the lyrics to very many of the songs. It was the rush and the absolutely clear expressiveness of those songs that I knew by heart. And I discovered years later that I'd actually been singing sort of made-up words to quite a lot of those songs that I loved. I just invented sort of verbals. And when it came to writing Mayflies, to go back to your question, I felt it was a technical issue. How to, as it were, get the sensibility of that time and that love of those particular bands into the sentences without quoting the lyrics again and again. Now, there are very straightforward financial reasons for not wanting to quote loads of lyrics from famous bands, and that is that they want 5,000 quid every time you quote a line, or some do. I ran into that very early, that I realised that it wouldn't be feasible to go quoting every time the boys had something to say to each other. They would shout lyrics at each other. Actually, although that might happen, what was more interesting to me was, in a sense, rewriting the lyrics and finding the sensibility in expressions of my own. And so in the concert, for example, in Manchester, where all the boys are heaving forward towards the stage when Morrissey appears and the Smiths are there in their great pomp, there in 1986, the Queen is Dead album has just come out. Morrissey is the most kind of interesting, radical voice in the independent scene. He's shouting against the royal family. He's shouting against the Thatcher government. He's a sort of radiating figure of importance to people like us at that age. But I didn't want to quote him. So what I did instead was I found a sort of creative solution in giving the boys things to say to each other and ways of thinking too. The narrator's way of thinking about the scene and expressing and ruminating was, as it were, tinged with all the sensibility of those songs. And yet I wrote the lyrics myself. And that seemed to me to do the job. And I think I invited readers to respond to that rather than, you know, bought in lyrics from There Is a Light That Never Goes Out, as it were. Songs would have been useful to me in that way, but it would have been a shorthand, which I think it was better in a way. Circumstances, difficult circumstances, sometimes force a writer to come up with something else. And I was glad in the end that I had to.
Because Utopia Avenue never existed, David, you had to invent their music. And in fact, the book is littered with the lyrics of their songs, which you wrote yourself. And I wonder, because I read in the introduction to Kate Bush's published lyrics, which you wrote, a lovely line of yours, which says that lyrics detached from songs are like a ship in dry dock, which might be of interest to a shipwright, but, you know, it's not the real thing. And I wonder, when you were writing the lyrics for your band, Utopia Avenue, did you have the sound of the music in your head?
It was a process, as all my novels are. I go wrong quite badly early on and then learn from how I've gone wrong and then try and fail a bit better and then try and fail a bit better. And with luck, by the fourth time or fifth time, I know what I'm doing. The solution I hit upon for my fictitious songs was to take a real song with a great melody and erase the lyrics and then rewrite my own lyrics, kind of float them onto the template of somebody else's song. So I always knew what the tune was. The whole process did give me a heightened respect for the lyricists of the world who write without music. I believe Bernie Taupin, Elton John's lyricist, he goes first. And how he does that, I have no idea. So that was the process with my fictional songs. I'm really interested in what Andrew was saying about almost the oxymoron of a novel about music. Up to a point, text on the page and great lyrics that you hear kabooming through the air are opposites. And it's quite a perverse thing to try to do, which, of course, is why I guess we were both attracted to it. How can you possibly get the thrill of a Smiths concert or any concert onto a page? How can you pull that off? But of course, it's the difficult things that attract you to it. Novels don't have speakers. If we were making a film, if we were writing a screenplay, we wouldn't have this problem. But no, for our sins, we're literary novelists. And so we do have to try to grapple with these impossibilities. And it sounds as if Andrew and I would both have come upon similar solutions on the long and winding road of working out this dilemma. One of which is, if you can't describe the music, and you can't because a page of description of, say, Our Friends Electric, the song itself is a visceral, gorgeous, indescribable thrill. But what you can do is describe the impact of the music upon the person. Literature is actually really good at that. It's really good at human sensation and the way the body feels something. You can describe that really well. So my main concert scene where Utopia Avenue were playing a gig in Edinburgh, I think, not too far away from Andrew, relatively at least, I've got a character just with her beer. She's leaning against the stage, as people did in these pre-health and safety ages. And the band member, who's the point of view narrator for that show, is sort of using this fan as a barometer. And we sort of, or my intention at least, is to show the temperature and the air pressure of the music at any one time by what is happening on the fan's face. Writing the book was a question of answering the question, how can you do it? How can you write about music? How can you do this impossible thing? And every time I came up with a different answer to that question, lo and behold, pretty much a new chapter came along.
I think it's worth considering why, for a second, sometimes very frustrated lyricists can't write novels. They don't understand the acoustics of a novel in the way that they do a three-minute pop song. I mean, very high examples in this area. Bob Dylan, for one, wrote a terrible novel, Tarantula. Morrissey, the aforementioned, wrote a bad novel. They didn't understand, as I say, the acoustics and what a novel's capaciousness means, how the challenge is to manipulate sentences, paragraphs, and chapters, perhaps, with a certain sense of social hyper-reality or even simply social reality. What they did instead was try to sort of write statement-y novels, which, rather than the style of lyrics, sort of threw out images and opinions and voicings in a rather regimented way. They couldn't write novels, those guys, any more than I, by the way, I completely admit, could write wonderful lyrics. I mean, I take my hat off to Bob Dylan. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature for a reason. I couldn't touch the hem of his gown. But when it came to writing novels, and here we are, two novelists talking about music, I think it's worth making the point that the traffic doesn't flow equally in each direction, if you know what I mean. It's difficult for a lyricist, by, I think, the very nature of their genius, it's difficult for them to become subcutaneous, if you like, go under the skin in the way that a novelist absolutely must, in terms of discursive prose.
You're listening to the Big Weekend of Books on Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford from The Music Show, and I'm speaking to the writers Andrew O'Hagan and David Mitchell. If you missed the start of this conversation or any of this weekend's sessions, you can find the audio on the ABC Listen app and on the Big Weekend of Books website. Just head to the RN website and look for Big Weekend of Books. We're talking about music in literature, and particularly music in their most recent novels, David Mitchell's Utopia Avenue, which I should have said and didn't, is actually set in the late 1960s, and Andrew O'Hagan's Mayflies, which is set in his own youth and is indeed about his own youth. The one thing, of course, that you can do in a novel is take musical structure, because music is nothing if it's not structure. And I read Andrew's novel first, and it's very much, as the sports commentators say, a novel of two halves. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, this is almost like an album, two sides of an album. And then I thought, actually, it's not even that. It's a single. It's a double A side. It's Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, because we jump ahead many years at the center point, and it's the whole tone of the novel changes. But then, David, your novel is absolutely, it spells it out, the structure. It's three albums, each with two sides, each with three or four or five songs on, and that gives you the structure. And I wonder if perhaps each of you could talk about the way in which you structured your work. Maybe, Andrew, you'd like to go first. Maybe you're offended by my Beatles analogy.
Not in the slightest. I find it quite helpful and indeed completely winning to consider it that way. One of the things that I've always admired about David Mitchell's work, right from the beginning, and we have careers that in terms of time run almost completely parallel. His wonderful first book, Ghostwritten, was published more or less at the same time as my first book. And I've watched every book of his with such keen interest. He's such a beautiful writer. And I think that one of the things I want to say on this subject is that architecture, and a novelist's passion for the architecture of their works, is sort of everything to me. And he, I think, is perhaps the greatest presently writing at that. To build books in a particular way, very deliberately, painstakingly, with an absolute sense that the reader will trust you if you do it properly. Now, for my own part, Mayflies arrived in my head, and then what was worked through many drafts, but arrived in my head as a book of two halves, as you call it. I knew that I must trust the reader to jump 30 years. The book starts in 1986, tells of a weekend, a bunch of Glasgow boys between 18 and 20 years old turn up in Manchester for what they imagine will be the gig of their lifetime, the 10th anniversary of punk rock happening in Manchester with all these bands, The Fall, The Smiths, New Order, all their favourite bands. I knew that that was going to be a detailed narrative about a weekend from all those years ago, and then the book would stop that night as they drunk and absolutely sort of glimmering with joy would end their evening, and it would jump 30 years to what was going to happen to one of the boys, and then how their friendship would be both explored and perhaps tested 30 years later. And I knew that I wouldn't fill that 30 years with narrative. And I think that's an architectural question. You simply must trust, if you're an experienced novelist, create the conditions, if you like, wherein you can trust your reader will make that leap and will fill those years in their own imagination, just as happens when you meet somebody in the street 30 years on you haven't seen since school. You don't stand frozen to the pavement. You begin talking. You make assumptions. You look at their eyes. You look at their face. You think about how their hair used to be. You might remember a kiss you had at the end of some school disco 30 years ago, and then you walk on and you think about them, but you make the jump. And I wanted the readers of this novel to do that. It was an architectural question that came very natural to me. I'd love to hear David on this, because his are often much more complex and intriguing to all of us, I think.
Well, firstly, I've got to say thank you so much for the kind things you say about my writing. The feeling is mutual, sir. And if Andrew O'Hagan had a superpower, if we were sort of in some sort of CD Marvel's Suicide Squad-esque Avengers Assemble sort of a context, which is quite a thought. But Andrew's superpower would be the manipulation of time, absolutely. Andrew doesn't work with time, he works with times. There are multiple times that go at different speeds and do different things to human beings and their relationships in the same novel, and how he does that, it's just magic to me. Regarding time and Utopia Avenue and structure, in a sense, it refers back to a previous answer about how on earth can you write a novel about music? It's almost sort of Bob the Builder stuff rather than magician stuff, but I simply broke down what a novel's made of: plot, character, themes or ideas, style and structure, and tried to sort of veer or steer each of these or infuse them with music, musical ideas, musical subjects, as much as I could. How could you do that with music? I mean, with structure. I just had the idea, well, the LP, this was a dominant art form of our youth. It isn't really of kids these days. They have Spotify and the like, and the world sort of swung back round to singles or at most EPs. But I think for all three of us in our youths, the A narrative journey was the journey that an LP took you on. I was far less cool in my musical taste, so you won't be surprised to learn, than Andrew. I did actually buy Yes albums with my own money. That's not as embarrassing as it was. They're having a bit of a renaissance, I think in part because of the musicianship, and in part just because arguably in some ways it was punk that was the conservative element. Four guys, guitar, bass, drum, vocals, three chords if you're lucky. It's actually in some ways going back to the 50s, to rock and roll, one could argue, whereas prog rock with their weird and wonderful time signatures that'll change eight times a song, these not only 12-minute songs, but songs that would take, that would fill up not only the whole side of an LP, but the whole of a double album. Yes, Tales of the Topographic Oceans by Yes, I'm talking to you. So that structure was there. Just the idea that a song, that an album can be a journey, and that it's not for nothing that When I'm 64 comes after Within You Without Me on Sgt. Pepper's. The placing of those two next to each other, they make a third thing. There's one song, then there's another, and then there's the fact that they're next to each other, and that little oboe or clarinet, I think, at the beginning of When I'm 64 comes in this sort of English parochial seaside postcard way, after the weird and wonderful exotic orientalist shimmering of George Harrison's sole contribution to that album. I love that stuff. I love how two artistic units can make a third thing by being next to each other. I love how an album can kind of be a wave, and the photon of your attention just sort of travels along that wave, and it's passed on from song to song to song to song, and its colour shifts spectrally as it moves along. I love how I can get endlessly nerdy about this, and I won't, but I suppose I already am doing, but how A Day in the Life is the whole of the album in miniature. It's got the McCartney bit, it's got the Lennon bit, it returns, they play off one another. It's just gorgeous. So in a sense, the LP was my childhood-long, adolescent-long masterclass in how to structure an artistic thing. In my case, it turned out to be the novel rather than music. Luckily for everyone who's ever heard my voice or heard me try to play the piano, but for better and worse, that's it. However, the shadow of the LP cast a very, very long, influential shadow indeed, and it's a shadow whose colours I am very fond of, as you can hear.
Yeah, you can hear it. And also, I must say that when you were talking there about Sgt. Pepper, it reminded me of reading your novel, Utopia Avenue, and of how much I wanted to hear Utopia Avenue's albums. you made them seem very real indeed. You're listening to Radio National's Big Weekend of Books. I'm Andrew Ford from The Music Show, and I'm talking to two of my favourite writers, David Mitchell and Andrew O'Hagan. David, I've got an eye on the clock and see that it's ticking by, but we must talk about the characters in Utopia Avenue. The main characters, you know, the band and their manager, are in a sense composites of 1960s musicians, you know, the taciturn drummer and the moody bass player and the sort of posh female singer, and they rub shoulders with other familiar faces in the form of characters from a number of your earlier books, actually nearly all of your earlier books, and then they're also appearances, cameo appearances by the likes of Leonard Cohen and Janis Joplin and memorably Francis Bacon, and they kind of cross paths wonderfully. For example, as I was reading the first few pages about Elf, the singer in the band, I thought, oh, she's Sandy Denny. And then I turned the page and Sandy Denny herself walks in to the novel. So there's a wonderful sort of playfulness going on with these characters. And I wonder if you could reasonably briefly explain how you set about keeping these characters together and apart on the page.
It made sense that the cameos would happen because it was quite a small scene. To us, it's vast. It's the 60s. It's the end of the 60s. It's multinational, multicultural. It's a super organism. In reality, if you're there was a relatively small number of clubs, a relatively small number of streets in Soho where your profession was pliable. They did run into each other all the time. And you get that sense from reading the memoirs and biographies from people who were there. And I'm sure Andrew's read a lot of those as well. Regarding the characters, it's a matter of cliche avoidance. You have to get characters who could feasibly be who I'm saying they were, a drummer. At the end of the 60s, a female vocalist of that era. They can't come from another planet altogether. However, they can't be who you've encountered 100 times in other stories, in other people's books. The music novel has a form. It has its tropes, and it's usually more male than Utopia Avenue. It's usually more of a rise and fall of Utopia Avenue. There's a hard scrabble beginning. They usually meet each other at school, as happened in reality or art college. So every time I identified a trope, I tried to do the opposite. The manager usually rips them off. There's usually a drug dependency issue, et cetera, et cetera. So I tried to do the opposite of every trope or every cliche that I came across, that I identified, and let those make the decisions about the band for me.
Andrew, would you say something about, Andrew O'Hagan, I'm interested that you were in fact in a band with your friend on whom your character Tully is based, and yet you chose not to be in a band in the book, but to be listening to bands.
Well, you know, as David just said, you know, sometimes it's cliche avoidance. Our friend Roger Doyle, many years ago now, wrote The Commitments, a rather wonderful book full of liveliness and truth, I think, about what it's like to be in a band. And I think that some of that has become quite familiar since then. And what I wanted to do was look at the characters and how they were shaped by the bands that they loved. You know, my late father was a teenager in 1956 when the teenager was invented, you know, and he was still listening to Perry Como and Nat King Cole, and he still found easy listening to be the stuff that described him and his emotions, his desires and his plans. He never really got into rock and roll, but when you look at the teenagers, especially in Britain of that period, you know, you look at the novelists, some of them working class novelists in the north, like Alan Sillitoe, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning's central character, Arthur Seaton, is, you know, he slicks up his hair. He's probably been listening to some of those early rock and rollers, but he still takes his character from his circumstances, from his father, from his factory where he works, from the pub where he drinks. Now, the difference that I tried to map out and have tried to, in a sense, anatomize in this novel, As Casually As You Like, is that my generation of teenagers were not defined by those things. They were defined a bit like Gary Numan in Tubular Army, the song I chose for you today. They were defined by popular culture, by loving bands, by loving movies. These boys in my novel express their character almost in absentia. That's to say, they express it by transferring it onto the movies and the songs that they love and find in common. They define themselves communally. according to popular culture. And that was something that I wanted to get into the novel at the level of the sentence. I wanted the reader to experience that. And a sense of authenticity, if you like, as used to be held up as a standard of the novel. Critics used to talk about authenticity. My view of it is that I wanted to get the core of their inauthenticity. In a Gary Newman-like sense, I wanted to show you them looking in the mirror at themselves looking back. And that's the boys, and that's the characters that I wanted to bring alive for the reader with this book.
We are out of time almost, but I did promise our listeners two songs, and we heard Gary Newman and Tubeway Army at the start of our conversation. David Mitchell, I've already mentioned Kate Bush. You chose Hounds of Love. This is an interesting song, isn't it? It's a very unsettling one.
It's unsettling, it's mad, it's many things. I've been thinking about Tubeway Army as well and Offence Electric, and what it has in common is they're both the products of militant dreamers. I don't know much about Andrew's background and his childhood, but I suspect there are overlaps. And one was that we weren't at school in places where it was particularly easy to be a kind of dreamy future novelist. Yes. I worked that much out, mate. And these avatars that appeared on Top of the Pops, they didn't give a damn. They had these visions, these William Blake level thermonuclear strange alternative ways of being and of living, and they put them into songs. Gary Newman, one lyric, he has a friend called Five. Fancy having a friend called Five. I wanted to be in that world. Likewise, Kate Bush here. What is this song about? I knew and I didn't. The words sort of defied sense if you look at them full on, but if you look at them sideways, it's sort of about the beginnings of awakening sexuality, which would be bang on for the age when I was. There's a fox that she finds and she holds it against herself and she hears its little beating heart, and the hounds of love are after it. Are the hounds dangerous? Are they inevitable? Are they on your side? Are they who you will be? I don't really know. In a sort of quantum way, all positions are possible at the same time. It's a sort of superposition of a song. It means multiple things. It sounds so mad. It's sort of, most songs are either piano based or guitar based, but here's this woman singing the way she does over drums. It's a drum driven song. It's percussive. I hadn't heard anything like it. To a degree, I still haven't. And I find it hard to talk about, as you can hear, just because it's beyond language. It defies language, it's above language, it's inside language, it uses language, it's sort of cubist and quantum and glorious, and that's about the best I can do. But here we are, Kate Bush, The Hounds of Love.
Listen, thank you very much indeed, David Mitchell. Thank you very much, Andrew O'Hagan. It's been such a pleasure talking to you both. I had so many more questions I wanted to ask you about, but I think that'll do. Thank you very much indeed, both of you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, too.
Kate Bush's Hounds of Love, as requested by my guest David Mitchell. I'm Andrew Ford, and you can tune into The Music Show each Saturday and Sunday morning. Meanwhile, there's plenty more listening from Radio National's Big Weekend of Books, online and on the ABC Listen app.